Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Next time somebody tells you Twitter doesn't matter, tell them to hush their mouths. A fake tweet sent Wall Street into a tailspin today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 23rd of April. Good to have you with us. Things were humming right along on Wall Street today. Major indices up, traders happy as clams, when all of a sudden, just a little bit after 1 in the afternoon, New York time, Twitter reared its ugly head. A fake report on the Associated Press Twitter feed, it had been hacked, it turns out, said there had been explosions at the White House and the president had been injured. Let me say that one more time. It was a fake report. Wall Street, of course, didn't know it at the time. The Dow lost 150 points pretty much in the blink of an eye. Then about 2 minutes later, got it all back again. Scary, but not as bad as it could have been, I guess. For all the peril that Twitter might bring with it, there is no small amount of commercial promise with that company, too. We learned today Twitter has made a deal with the ad firm Starcom. It's going to bring Twitter and TV together. And as with everything nowadays, it's all about the ads. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
It's official. We're a nation of social media addicts. When we watch TV, nearly 90% of us are simultaneously checking our phones or computers or both. That worried TV networks, says William Ward, a professor of social media at Syracuse University.
Initially, there was a lot of fear, like, oh my gosh, they're not watching their shows, they're doing other things.
And then TV shows started using social media to deepen their relationship with audiences. AMC's zombie hit, The Walking Dead, displays hashtags on the screen that fans use to chat on Twitter during the show.
They were saying on the news some kind of virus. Things got crazy.
Might sound crazy, but a recent report from Nielsen found Twitter activity has a major impact on TV ratings. Now Twitter and TV shows want to cash in on that connection. Starcom's Lisa Weinstein helped orchestrate the deal.
If you think about Twitter as a real-time marketplace, a 24/7 marketplace, that's certainly an exciting space to be.
Under the deal, Starcom clients would pay to have promoted material on Twitter. Starcom and Twitter are also creating a lab to explore new advertising possibilities.
The holy grail for advertisers right now is engagement.
Michael Serrazio is the author of Your Ad Here.
They'd really try to coordinate and harness all of that energy and buzz and social media momentum around a particular plotline or character.
Serrazio says the Twitter-Starcom partnership will be all about finding the best ways to convert this new audience engagement into cold, hard cash. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Last week, after the marathon bombings, Boston Strong was the rallying cry up there. It was printed on posters and T-shirts and on the green monster, the left field wall out at Fenway Park. Now, as often happens with these kinds of things, somebody wants to trademark that phrase. Marketplace's David Gura has that story.
A registered trademark can be virtually anything. Dale Sandali is a partner at Kirkland & Ellis who teaches patent law at Harvard.
The NBC chimes, a particular color green, or even the sound of a Harley-Davidson engine, all those kinds of things could be trademarked.
Sandali says that to register a trademark, you have to show that it's being used for commercial purposes. That phrase, that sound, that object has to identify the company that's behind it. And there's the issue of fair use. Sandali says she finds it very hard to believe that people could be prevented from using a phrase like Boston Strong. Jennifer Taylor is an intellectual property lawyer with Morris & Forster.
We see this all the time, and it happens for celebratory events, and it also happens in times of tragedy like this.
In the late 80s, NBA coach Pat Riley won the right to license the phrase three-peat. On 9/11, Todd Beamer, a passenger on United Flight 93, said, "Let's roll." That's a phrase the Todd M. Beamer Foundation now has rights to. Born Into It is one of the parties trying to register Boston Strong. In a statement, the company claims it has no intention of policing the trademark. It wants to make sure others don't profit from it. Boston University law professor Stacey Dogan says that makes it unlikely Born Into It's application will be successful.
Someone who says, I want to register this mark so that other people can't claim rights to it, but I'm going to allow others freely to use it, is basically conceding that the term has no trademark significance.
As the government grapples with what could go on T-shirts, Nike has had to grapple with what's already on some. The apparel maker pulled a shirt it designed for Yankees fans months ago. It read, Boston Massacre, alluding to an attack by British soldiers in 1770 and a couple of series with the Red Sox. That's a phrase that means something different to many people today. I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
We buy more and more stuff online every single year. That means more and more business for the companies that ship all those packages. But the competition there is fierce. So now it's not enough just to get the deliveries to your door. It's all about when you want to get your package and where you want to get it. Two of the biggest in the business, FedEx and UPS, are going at it in that slice of the market. Shannon Mullen reports.
FedEx's biggest rival, UPS, rolled out its My Choice service more than a year and a half ago, and it's approaching 3 million users. They can pay a $5 fee to reroute packages, or $40 a year for premium perks like a 2-hour delivery window. Now FedEx is launching a similar service called Delivery Manager. Same fees for mostly the same options, but spokeswoman Carla Boyd says there's no subscription cost.
We do not lock users of the service into a premium-priced membership to access the options that they want.
Boyd says FedEx is responding to market research on the growth of online sales. They increased 28% last year over the year before, says the National Retail Federation. Vicki Cantrell heads the NRF's digital division, shop.org.
E-commerce sales are what's driving the increase in retail sales across the industry.
And the big parcel carriers are looking for ways to respond, says shipping industry consultant Satish Jindal.
UPS is clearly ahead.
Jindal says he thinks the name UPS My Choice is more consumer-friendly than FedEx Delivery Manager.
It is amazing that FedEx is such a marketing-oriented company that they would have come up with a very boring and a technical name for a service that's meant for a consumer, not for a transportation manager.
But Jindal says both companies face the same challenge. As more retailers offer free shipping, consumers might not want to pay for shipping perks. I'm Shannon Mullen for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, well, let's see. There was the aforementioned tweet retreat. There were corporate profits. Apple did all right. Thank you very much. And there was the usual stuff as well. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. For all the talk you hear about Silicon Valley being a hotbed of innovation, one can only assume that people who say that have never actually been there, because minus the mountains and the scenery, it's pretty much mile after suburban mile of office parks. Apple and Google are aiming to change that, though, with new multi-billion dollar buildings they're putting up. Marketplace's Queen of Kent reports.
I'm standing on Wolf Road in the city of Cupertino. It's about an hour south of San Francisco, and right now I'm looking at the site of what's going to be Apple's new headquarters. It's a 176-acre site filled with vacant office parks and what looks like miles and miles of parking lots. But when Apple's finished here in a couple of years, all this will be erased, and what we're going to see is a gigantic circular building. One building made out of glass that holds 12,000 people.
Some people have described it as the mothership that has landed, or a place for some kind of harmonic convergence, or as an iPod click wheel.
That's Brian Shermer, a professor of architecture at the University of Wisconsin. And like Apple's most iconic products, the building will be a wonder of technology and design. It'll generate its own electricity with more than 700,000 square feet of solar panels. The center of the circle, which is about a mile across, will be filled with apple orchards and trails. And the building itself will be sheathed in gigantic 40-foot-high panels of curved glass, something that's never been tried before. Here's the late Steve Jobs, with his usual modesty, presenting plans for Apple's new headquarters to the Cupertino City Council in 2011.
I think we do have a shot of building the best office building in the world. And I really do think architecture students will come here to see this.
The new Apple headquarters will sit on the hallowed ground of Hewlett-Packard's former headquarters, the company that started it all. but it couldn't be a bigger break from Silicon Valley's architectural tradition. Luis Manzingo is a professor at UC Berkeley and the author of Pastoral Capitalism, A History of Suburban Corporate Landscapes. She says for all the glamour associated with tech these days, the architecture in Silicon Valley can be summed up in two words: office parks.
They're kind of like the building and landscape version of khakis and polo shirts.
Not very sexy, but adaptable.
Your company booms, you move outward, your company shrinks, new innovators come in, they take over.
With its new headquarters, Apple is changing that paradigm.
This kind of move on the part of a corporation represents a company that's matured and has an interest in sort of being seen as a kind of institution.
About 10 miles north in Mountain View, Google's putting forward a different vision with its new headquarters called Bayview. If Apple's about an ecosystem where the iPod, iPhone, and iPad feed into each other in an endless circle, Google's business is more unpredictable. Anthony Ravitz works on Google's real estate and workplace services team.
Our business is constantly changing.
While Google makes most of its money off search, it's also into smartphones, driverless cars, electronic wallets, and it's set to release Google Glass, a wearable computer that sits on your face like glasses.
In 50 years, what will our business look like, and how can we evolve the space over time?
The answer is Bayview, which is made up of about a dozen buildings that look very much like an office park. The J-shaped buildings fit together around a series of courtyards, and the campus sits right on the southern shores of the San Francisco Bay. Google is restoring the wetlands around it and creating a natural habitat for its own workers. There will be paths along the water for jogging and bike riding and places for Googlers to practice yoga or ride scooters on the rooftop gardens.
We definitely want this campus to be a reflection of our culture, and whimsy is a part of that.
Google believes innovation can't be planned, but it can be fostered by creating spaces where employees can run into each other and share ideas. Luis Manzingo, the UC Berkeley professor, says that Google's new headquarters is iconic in its own way. It's not about the building, but the idea that you can actually create spaces that lead to innovation.
Each one of these very much reflect a different kind of corporate persona.
Manzingo says Apple and Google could cement Silicon Valley's reputation as ground zero for technological and architectural innovation. And we'll know in a few years if the tour buses start rolling by. In San Francisco, I'm Queenie Kim for Marketplace.
Architecture's tough on the radio. We know that. So we've got drawings and pictures of some of the buildings Queenie was talking about at marketplace.org. And now, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials drove 152 points higher today, 1%, 14,719 for the blue chips. The NASDAQ added 35 points, 1%, finished at 3269. The S&P 500 up 16 points, 1%, 1578, the number you're looking for there. Netflix flew up 24% today. That after adding a slew of new subscribers and beating expectations. Apple ticked up nearly 2% before the close, and it's better than expected earnings. There were gains across a broad swath of the market. Don't know that I've ever said swath in the segment of the broadcast before. DuPont rose 4% today after doubling profits and boosting dividends. MetLife adjusted upward by 5.5% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.70%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. On Capitol Hill, Congress's Joint Economic Committee discusses long-term unemployment, consequences, and solutions. Did you purchase a blender or a computer last month? In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on durable goods orders for March. And earnings season continues. Tupperware announces first quarter results. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. As you get to thinking about what you're going to make for dinner tonight, ask yourself this question, would you? Does it involve pushing a button on a microwave, or does it involve a long, slow simmer on a stovetop? Michael Pollan is hoping for the latter. His latest book, Cooked, it's called, is all about the making of a meal. Michael, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kai. Good to be here.
You've been writing about food and the food ecosystem and all of that for a good long while. But how did you have this epiphany about cooking, which is kind of the middle ground of the extremes you've been writing about?
Yeah, well, you know, I've been writing about the food chain for about 12 years. And I realized along the way that I hadn't paid attention to this missing middle link, which is to say how the food gets transformed before we eat it. And it turns out it's probably the most important link of all.
But the link at which we are spending less and less time, you point out.
Well, cooking, yeah. We're seeing the gradual collapse of home cooking since 1977. It's fallen by half. Only about 57% of meals are cooked, according to the marketers, but they define cooking very loosely. Making a sandwich is cooking. So scratch cooking, making things from, you know, raw ingredients, is really vanishing from our culture with, I think, disastrous effects both for our agriculture and for our health.
I don't argue the point, but let me, just for the heck of it, be the devil's advocate here. In a world where time is increasingly money, baby, cooking just takes a lot of time.
Yeah, it does. But you know what, Kai? We find time for the things we value. In the last 10 years alone, we found 2 hours a day to surf the internet outside of work. So, you know, I think the problem is we don't value cooking. And we've fallen into this kind of mode where we let corporations do the cooking for us. The problem is they don't do it very well.
Yeah, explain that a little bit. I mean, beyond processed foods and making life simpler, what do you mean?
Well, when corporations cook, they buy the cheapest possible raw ingredients, and then they dress them up with lots of salt, fat, and sugar to make them acceptable. And then they have to use lots of food additives to keep the food from looking like it's not from so far away or so long ago. And the result is not very healthy food. So it may be efficient to rely on them, but this is a great case where the efficiency of capitalism is actually undermining the health of people.
Short of A, reading this book, B, listening to this interview, or C, just discovering it on your own, though, how does one convince others that cooking in and of itself has merit?
I really think we've been sold a bill of goods with the argument that this is drudgery and we don't have time and we lack the skills. It's one of the most democratic of pleasures available to all of us. And so I'm hoping that this, you know, that the work I've done, which got me more excited, will do the same for other people and really help us turn off the marketing messages, which are really designed to get us out of the kitchen. There's a reason for that, you know. All the money in the food industry is in processing. It's very hard to make money selling simple ingredients. And you know what? The only way we're going to get a more humane and sustainable agriculture is if people are willing to buy more directly from farmers and work those transformations of their food themselves.
Cooked is the latest book from Michael Pollan. Michael, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
Today is, give or take a couple of days, the 449th anniversary of William Shakespeare's birth. Nobody's exactly sure when he was born, but today's a pretty close guess. As for why I'm telling you that, well, according to a group of researchers at Aberystwyth University in Wales, Shakespeare wasn't only about sonnets and tragedies. He was apparently motivated in no small part by money and might not have been such a nice guy in pursuit of it. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has more on the bard as businessman.
Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate.
The man who wrote these ethereal lines was not walking around with his head in the clouds. Far from it. Literary researchers Jane Archer and Richard Margrave Turley say the bard focused relentlessly on the bottom line.
What we are revealing is the very hard-headed business acumen of William Shakespeare.
Well, we're able to see him as an astute and arguably ruthless businessman.
In spite of his majestic themes and the nobility of his mind, Shakespeare seemed obsessed with money, eager to live down his father's financial failure, always on the lookout for a quick buck, even to the point of disregarding these wise words from one of his own plays.
Neither a lender nor a borrower be, for loan oft loses both itself and friend, and borrowing dulls the edge of husbandry.
Yes, the bard was both borrower and lender, says Jane Archer of Aberystwyth University.
that this is a man who lent money, who pursued people through the courts when they did not repay on time, who also took out loans from other individuals and did not repay those.
It gets worse. Jane says the so-called Swan of Avon engaged in some pretty murky commodity dealing, stockpiling grain at a time of near famine.
He buys an illegal quantity of grain, of barley, to sell at a later date at inflated prices, probably in the late winter, early spring, when people are at their most desperate for food.
Grain hoarder, moneylender and profiteer. Oh, and he was a tax evader too. This sounds sleazy today, but Jane's co-researcher, Richard Margrave Turley, says that's because we don't understand the harsh realities of 16th century life. And we have a romantic notion about what motivates a towering talent like Shakespeare.
This is the idea of great artists as geniuses who are driven to write for art's sake. That's a post-romantic view. It's not a view of Shakespeare that his contemporaries would have recognised.
Shakespeare, he says, was in it for the money, writing plays, running a theatre, dealing in grain and cutting corners. It all seemed the same to him, a way to survive and prosper.
What a piece of work is man!
Was the bard himself a piece of work? No, say the researchers. He was as complex, flawed and human as the characters he created. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
We are, what, 6 or so weeks from prime outdoor grilling season in most parts of the country. But you know what? No such thing as being too prepared. So as you begin to consider your Memorial Day barbecue plans, we are here to help with a guy who knows a thing or two about buying a grill and cooking the meat on it. Meathead Goldwyn of AmazingRibs.com. Meathead is what he prefers, by the way. That's what he told us. Meathead, it's good to have you with us.
What a pleasure.
So let me ask you this. How does one go about reviewing 300-some-odd grillers and smokers and barbecuers?
I have a equipment reviewer, a guy named Max Good, and he and I buy grills and smokers. We go out into the hardware stores and kick tires. We have not cooked on all 300. I'd say probably 100 of them or so, but we've got good intelligence on the rest.
All right, let me ask you some fairly nuts and bolts questions here. First of all, gas or charcoal, what do you like?
Ah, nothing beats charcoal for flavor. You get that really high temp that you need for a good dark mahogany sear on a steak. Now, gas grills have these new sear burners, which do really well.
Yeah, but isn't that cheating? Come on.
Well, I mean, all your big steakhouses cook on gas, man, you know.
Yeah.
And you can't beat gas for convenience. You know, you go out there, turn the switch, 10 minutes later, you're ready to rock and roll.
How much should I spend as an occasional weekend-ish grill guy? Bear in mind, I live in Southern California, so that's a lot of weekends.
Yeah, really. I think if you can spend $400 or so, you can get a pretty good tool. Well, I mean, if you're cooking on it a lot.
Yeah.
There are some nice gizmos out there in the $200 range, but they're not built to last.
Ah.
4 or 5 years out, things will start busting.
Are you a sauce guy or a dry rub guy?
Both.
Okay. No, you can't have it both ways.
Well, dry rub goes down first, always. For a lot of ribs, I eat them just rub only. But sauce is really nice, especially if you do it right.
All right. Now, I have a confession to make. I don't actually like to get messy when I eat, right? So ribs with sauce are problematical for me. How do you feel about pulled pork? I know. I can hear you exasperated.
No, pulled pork. And in fact, actually, when people ask me where to start, especially with smoked meats, pulled pork is absolutely the way to go. It is really forgiving. It's really hard to screw it up. You can either serve it on a sandwich or you can drizzle a little sauce on there.
You got to put sauce on it, right? I mean, come on.
Well, and taste is a matter of taste.
Yes, it is. What is the single most important thing I can do to make me a better griller?
Digital thermometer.
Really?
Absolutely. Food is ready to eat when it hits the target temperature.
You are totally taking all the magic out of this, man. Right? Whatever yeah, happened to being able to, you know, push
you gotta,
it and feel you it and
thump your
it,
chest,
and
you know.
Yeah, you know, come on.
You know, whoa. Yeah. This is the digital age, man. I'm sitting here with my iPad in front of me. You know, it's the way to do it.
Meathead Goldwyn at AmazingRibs.com. We have his recipe, by the way, for grilled sweet and sour pork. It's at marketplace.org. Meathead, thank you so much. I'm going to try this stuff tonight, man.
What a pleasure.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, which will come as a relief to the good people in the finance department here at Marketplace. I finished up about 2 months' worth of expense reports today. Kind of let them get away from me. Sorry about that. But maybe that's why this item caught my eye this morning. A report from the expense management firm Certify, its latest business travel spending survey. Number one among restaurants listed in expense reports. Take a second. You can probably get it. Starbucks, right? They're in airports everywhere. Marriott was the most expensed hotel. Delta led the airlines, none of which, by the way, show up on my reports the past couple of months. All right, we're done. We got to go. That's Marketplace from APM on this Tuesday. Today, the Dow up 152 points, about 1%. The NASDAQ added 35 points, 1% there. The S&P 500 gained 16 points. That is 1% after the tweet retreat of this Tuesday. Thanks to Sean Bowd. It's Katie Long, Lina Anwar, and Justin Ho on our morning report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rada Bead. I'm Kai Rizdal. What do you say? Yeah, we do it again tomorrow. Okay. Bye. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.